Good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Andrew Schwartz in External Relations here at CSIS. Dr. Flanagan's running a couple minutes late because I hear there's a mix-up on the red line, but we'll... All right. Well, we'll get started right away. And, you know, this is a timely briefing, obviously, if you've been following events in Europe. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Heather Conley, who's Senior Fellow and Director of the Europe Program at CSIS. Many of you have worked with Heather before, and you know that she served in the State Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary for European Affairs. And this is Heather.
Andrew, thank you so very much. What I thought I would do is really just set the scene a little bit, and then we'll go to the G8 summit. And I'm more than delighted to answer your specific questions about Europe and the evolving crisis. I think in many ways we are still feeling the tremendous aftershocks of elections 2 weeks ago, both French elections and Greek elections. And if your BlackBerries have been going off, we just received word a few moments ago that it looks like Athens has now set the timing for new elections next month, either June 10th or June 17th, that the call for a technocratic government has failed. So this will continue to be an ongoing story. We'll try to get, obviously, more information as we receive it. Clearly today, President Hollande is now inaugurated and on his way to Berlin. This also sets the tone, I think, for the context of the crisis. What will the French-German relationship be able to produce? Please recall that Mr. Hollande's campaign was that he was going to bring Europe to a growth agenda and to balance the austerity message. He may get a perfect opportunity to do this because of Greece. Basically, the decision that Europe will have to make very soon is whether Europe will continue to sustain and support the Greek package, the Greek bailout package, or they are willing to either renegotiate or provide more stimulus, more growth to help counter these austerity measures. And this indeed will play out over the next few days. So within that context, after Mr. Hollande visits Berlin and returns to Paris very briefly, he's on his way to Washington, and Friday we'll have a very important bilateral meeting with President Obama. And clearly the economy and the European debt crisis will be first and foremost on that bilateral conversation. And I think clearly President Hollande and President Obama see things very similarly about the need for a better balance between fiscal consolidation, austerity, and economic growth. Now, the challenge here is understanding the details of what that growth would look like. So far, what we're understanding from Brussels, that a package is being developed, potentially a companion piece, a growth compact that would go alongside the fiscal compact treaty that would look at greater enhancements of the European Investment Bank, retooling of EU cohesion and regional funds, and as much retooling as they can of existing funds. But I do not believe you'll see any stimulus spending, any deficit spending. But we will see how those arguments play out. But clearly, I think President Obama will want to send a reaffirming message that better balancing is required for Europe so we can quickly return to economic health. I think, again, after the economy, there is a series of foreign policy issues, really understanding President Hollande's position vis-a-vis Iran, Syria, really the entire Middle East package. Under President Sarkozy, France was a leader in really driving forward-looking policies. And I think there want to be some temperatures taken whether Mr. Hollande will continue that pattern of forward-leaning posture or not. Clearly on Afghanistan, and this will be a conversation that will my colleague Dr. Flanagan will talk about, but getting a sense from Mr. Hollande on his plans regarding Afghanistan and the removal of French combat combat forces by the end of the year, as well as French support in the post-Afghanistan transition period. So I think there will be this will be an important meeting. The relationship will have to be built very quickly, and in the next several days, that relationship and those key issues will certainly play out. And finally, before I turn this over to Matt to walk you through the G8 summit, I would argue in some respects this feels like we're picking up right where we left off after the G20 summit in Cannes. This is a Euro crisis summit. It will be dominated by the crisis. We have a new configuration of leaders, however. This is the first G8 in quite a while that Mr. Berlusconi will not be a participant, and we'll work closely with Mario Monti. And you'll have a new dynamic, a new European triangle, if you will, of President Hollande, Chancellor Merkel, and Prime Minister Monti, and to see whether that growth austerity balance can be achieved. Of course, you'll have Mr. Barroso, Mr. Van Rompuy of the European Council and Commission. And then, you have Prime Minister Cameron, who certainly has been struggling lately, local elections, opinion polls. He, too, is struggling with a very challenged British economy at the moment. So you have some new faces at this G8, but you still have the same challenges. What have we been talking about? We'll be talking about Greece again. So with that, I'll turn it over to Matt. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Thanks, Andrew. excuse me. Yes, there is still a G8, and as Heather has suggested, it's actually going to be a little more interesting than I think might have been expected initially. So this is just to go through the facts. This is the sixth time that the United States has hosted the G8 summit since it started as the G5/6 in 1975. The meetings will be held from Friday evening, May 18th, through Saturday the 19th at Camp David. As you know, it was originally scheduled to be held in Chicago, but it was moved to Camp David by President Obama in March. I think he decided to move it because of security concerns, but also I think really because he wanted a more quiet setting. And Chicago, and I was there last week, is already going crazy, and I think he could see that it wasn't going to be a place to facilitate a really quiet, sort of intimate conversation. This will, by the way, just fun facts, this is the largest group of foreign leaders that has ever been at Camp David at one time for any meeting. I believe it's the first international economic meeting at Camp David ever, and it is the first these will be the first foreign leaders of any kind that President Obama has ever had at Camp David. There are 10 members of the G8, as Heather has suggested. There are the 8 countries involved, and then the European Union has 2 seats in addition. And as Heather said, theoretically 4 of the 10 members are new, if you count President Putin. But A, he's been there before, and B, he's not coming this time. So there will only be the 3 new faces: Hollande, Monti, and then Noda of Japan, which is, of course, I won't comment on that, on Japan. And there will probably be a short communique on Saturday afternoon and a bunch of annexes on various topics. So the White House has set basically 4 or 5 core priorities for the summit. First and foremost is the global economy. That's always true at a G8 summit, but this year, of course, the Eurozone, as Heather said, is going to dominate. I mean, there's also concerns about growth in China and in the U.S. and Japan. So, I mean, there's a broader story as well about the global economy, but certainly the Eurozone conversation is going to dominate. I think the White House does not want to have a sterile debate about growth versus austerity, but inevitably that is going to be, a theme in the conversation. Secondly, they want to put an emphasis, and I'd say this is the highest next priority, on Africa and food security. Africa, as you know, has been a traditional element of the G8 summit for the last at least decade. But the White House wants to do two things differently this year. First of all, they don't want to have the usual parade of dictators, just to have a representative group of African leaders. They're actually choosing only four African leaders based on, well, one is the current chairman of the AU, Mr. Boni of Benin, but the other three were chosen because they have facilitated or encouraged innovative approaches to food security. And those are Prime Minister Meles of Ethiopia, President Kikwete of Tanzania, and President Atta Mills of Ghana. And so they were chosen based on the sort of underlying policy efforts that they had made to promote innovative approaches to increasing agricultural productivity and encouraging investment and so forth. And so those will be the topics that the White House will try to highlight at the summit, and there will probably be a few private sector entrepreneurs and others from those African countries present in Camp David. Also, because African food security have been major topics of conversation in the past, there have been previous commitments made, notably at L'Aquila in 2009, where there was a food security initiative launched with money behind it, and they will review progress on following through on those commitments, but there will not be any new money commitments, pledges on food or anything else at this summit. And then I'll just quickly run through the other agenda items. Will be the Middle East and North Africa. Last year, the French were frankly lucky because the Arab Spring happened just before their summit, which otherwise would have been a bit of a bust. They ended up having a very interesting, useful conversation with the leaders of Egypt and Tunisia and launching the Deauville Partnership to support reform and transition in the Middle East and North Africa. They came up with a kind of made-up number of $38 billion of G8 support for the region, which will not be part of the conversation this year. The White House wants to focus on three broad areas: financial stabilization and job creation, secondly, participation and governance questions, and thirdly, trade and investment integration in the region. So those will be the topics there. The other issues on the agenda will be Afghanistan, not to preempt the NATO conversation, but to talk about long-term economic support for Afghanistan, which the U.S. has put, obviously, a lot of emphasis on. And then finally, as always at a G8 summit, there will be a discussion of global hotspots, Syria, Iran, North Korea, and issues of proliferation and so forth. And then some discussion of trade, energy, and climate change, but I'd say those will probably be lower on the agenda. In terms of expectations, I think certainly the White House is trying to keep expectations low. They're calling this a back-to-basics summit. Actually, the Canadians came up with that term 2 years ago, and the French tried to use that term as well, and it was far from basic. But I think this year, because of the setting and the tone the White House is trying to set, I think it will be probably closer to that. There will not be any big new initiatives or money, as I said. The communique will be short, mainly a reaffirmation of values and a sort of an account of actions that have already been taken by members of the G8. I think I'll stop there.
Before we go to Dr. Flanagan, I didn't get a chance to introduce all of you to Matt Goodman, who is new here at CSIS. He's, of course, you have his bio, but he's our new Simon Chair in Political Economy, and as many of you know, served in the White House prior to this, where he was responsible for the G20, G8, and other international forums. And with that, I'll give it to Dr. Flanagan.
Thanks, Andrew. Good morning. It's good to be with you. I thought I would give you first, for those of you especially who don't follow NATO regularly, just a little bit of context for this Chicago summit, and then talk about some of the expected outcomes, which I'm sure you're more familiar with. NATO is clearly an acquired taste, and despite the fact that our NATO ambassador managed to get on the Daily Show last week, you'll notice that if you saw it, that even he was asked, why do we even still have an ambassador to NATO anyway? What's all this about? But more seriously, I think what the theme, the overall context of this is, this summit comes only 18 months after what was seen as a very detailed and extensive two-year process of review of the alliance's core mission and strategic purpose. And some thought that this summit would largely be an implementation summit. There's a sense that the vision and mission statement that was adopted at the Lisbon summit in the end of 2010 remains valid. But the Obama administration, and the Obama administration certainly wants to show, as do other allies, that NATO is making good on those that vision and the mission statement, particularly with regard to Afghanistan. But there's also a recognition that given the dramatic developments in the international scene and, of course, in the fiscal health of all the member countries, that the alliance also has to show that it's adapting to these new strategic realities. The other context comment that I would just make is I think it's very important that this summit be seen as reaffirming both sides of the transatlantic compact, and there's a certain bit of nervousness on both sides. You all, of course, are quite familiar with the famous Gates speech in Brussels last year in June, where he basically articulated in the most forceful way possible the growing U.S. political concern about Europe's demilitarization and unequal sharing of burdens and risks within the alliance, and how that could erode the alliance over the longer term as American politicians become more transactional about their international commitments. But at the same time, European leaders are a bit concerned about the administration's reduction of the military presence in Europe, the realignment of diplomatic and military assets towards East Asia and the Pacific, and that might lead them to fend more with both regional disputes on their periphery by themselves and a sense of a diminishing common purpose. So I expect that President Obama will reaffirm, though, in Chicago, what he noted on the eve of the Lisbon summit at his Westminster speech, which the administration cites as kind of the touchstone of their Europe policy, that the United States does not have any partners in any other part of the world that shares, as he said, such close alignment of values, interests, capabilities, and goals. And the theme, I think, that he will sound and others in the administration will sound that Europe still remains Washington's reliable partner of choice in dealing with international security problems. Now, let me just turn quickly to the successful outcomes. You know, there's a three-part agenda: Afghanistan, military capabilities, and partnership. There are a couple of other lesser issues I'll touch on briefly. The first one, on Afghanistan, I think the key thing is that what's articulated is a credible commitment to assisting Afghanistan in maintaining its security through the transition to an Afghan lead in the maintenance of its own security in 2014 and beyond. And, of course, we know that there are 23 nations that have signed on so far. NATO has always been in a partnership. It's not just all the NATO member countries that are contributing in some ways, either with forces or other resources to the ISAF coalition, but there are also a number of other NATO partner countries and other countries that are not formally partners of the alliance. We know that those 23 have committed to some kind of funding, the package still to be determined. We can talk a little bit about the details, but roughly a $4 billion package, which the U.S. would contribute anywhere from a quarter to a half over the longer term to support a smaller Afghan National Security Force. Now, there's been some concern. There was some concern even going into last month's ministerial meeting of NATO foreign and defense ministers, where there would be some erosion of even that 2014 commitment, particularly with President Hollande, then candidate Hollande, declaring that he would pull forces a year earlier than Sarkozy had already hinted he would do. That is at the end of this year, as opposed to 2013. I just came back from Europe last night from some international conferences, met with a number of people that are close to the Hollande team. They've all assured me that Hollande does not want a problem with either Obama or other allies on this, and they will fudge this commitment. Now, how they're going to do that, I don't know. They could probably meld it somehow with the fact that a lot of allies have been talking about, and even Secretary Panetta, you'll recall earlier on, said we don't immediately stop combat operations. 2 days in a matter of 2 days, it's a process of disengagement, of turning over authority, and always this has been viewed as a phased transition. So I think Hollande will come up with some formula that will suggest that, well, it's not that we're going to have all these troops out at the end of this year, but they're going to be phasing down. Maybe the timetable will be accelerated in 2013, but I think he just has to do a little bit better than Sarkozy was already suggesting. But he certainly does not want a problem with the allies, particularly on this first meeting. The bigger question is the scope. There's no doubt that these countries are going to contribute resources. The question is, how are they going to contribute to the training and assistance programs to the Afghanistan in the military sector post 2014? Now, the U.S., as you know, has declared under this new charter of partnership a willingness to retain both military assistance under Afghan control and a training presence through 2024. None of the other allies have made anything that sweeping of a commitment. And of course, as many of you probably know, most allies have not met their pledges to the existing NATO training mission in Afghanistan over the past 4 years. So their willingness to do so after the ISAF forces are withdrawn, when they are even more dependent on Afghan forces for their security, particularly given the incidents we've seen of late, that's a key question. So it'll be very interesting to see what it is that allies actually agree to in terms of that residual training mission. Second, on the defense planning, what I think the Obama administration is hoping for is, in a sense, a European response to the Gates speech by an adopting of a commitment of enhancing alliance defense planning, a wiser use of resources over the coming decade, along with some flagship military initiatives. Since Lisbon, NATO has itself downsized its military commands and civilian agencies. It's become a leaner and somewhat more capable organization in its own internal processes. But there's also this initiative, Smart Defense, as it's called, a commitment that, in light of the fiscal constraints, to achieve a more effective use of defense resources through better prioritization and coordination of defense planning, multinational cooperation, and specialization. So those three general areas. The goal, though, is really to get Europe to spend the still enormous resources that it devotes to defense more wisely, but also to try to coordinate national defense plans more closely to ensure that NATO has the critical capabilities it needs for collective defense and other missions over the long term. Now, there's a related initiative called Connected Forces, which also seeks to do some of the same kinds of things, better coordination and integration of activities and training, exercise, and other support functions. And there'll be several sort of flagship capabilities initiatives, initial operating capability of the missile defense capability, this major initiative that has been stalled for some years, partly because of French resistance on improving Allied surveillance capabilities, which is, of course, a very strong response to some of the Libyan shortfalls that were revealed among allies, and then Baltic air policing, which is a key part of reassuring nervous Central and East European allies that we remain committed to their collective defense. There'll be a package of some other smaller initiatives, and then, more interestingly and hopefully, a longer-term set of commitments to enhancing joint intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance activities and air-to-air refueling. Some of these things have some real dividends for European defense industry if they can be supported, and that's one of the parts of this effort that Secretary Panetta has been advocating, which is to say that he called in February, it's great that we have smart defense, better use of resources, all these other things, but I want some kind of a vision, and it evolved out of his own thinking about the U.S. Joint Vision 2020 for its own forces. The idea that it's great to talk about resources, but where are we going? What's our overall strategic vision for the forces we want to have within the alliance? So this will is expected to be bundled up into some kind of a broader sort of framework called, which would be an implementation plan and some target goals called NATO Force 2020. So that's the package. My sense is that this is about the best, given the fiscal constraints that European governments confront, I think this is about the best we can do. And the question is now, can you sort of see the political resolve to carry through with this and to make some of the compromises on sovereignty and cooperation that they made in the financial area, in the defense area? That's going to be the key. Lastly, there's an effort to strengthen alliance partnerships. As I remember, over 50 countries that are in some ways in a partnership. The key thing that will be seen in Chicago is a meeting of the so-called core partners, 13 countries who have made substantial contributions to NATO operations, particularly Afghanistan, and to find ways to work more effectively with them. Advancement of NATO's partnership with Russia, of course, has been hampered by a lack of progress on missile defense, but there's still a hope that that Lavrov might come to the NATO-Russia Council meeting at some level, or to the there won't be a NATO-Russia Council meeting, but that he would come to the meeting of ISAF partners. Other issues, there'll be a statement on the deference and defense posture review, which will basically affirm the current mix of nuclear, conventional, and missile defense forces within the alliance. And there'll also be some statement on alliance commitment to further expansion, a meeting with the four so-called aspirant countries, the Macedonians, Montenegrins, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Georgia. But there will be no decisions taken on enlargement. So with that, I will close and look forward to your questions.
Okay, we'll take questions. If you're at the table, please speak into the microphone, identify yourself for the record. If you're in the back, please just identify yourself because you don't have a microphone. So let's, George.
George Condon with National Journal. You talked about the French election. What is the impact on the G8 summit of the American election? That always changes how the president gets to the summit. How will it change his approach? And do the allies understand that because of American election, that changes what they can get?
Sure. So obviously this is an election year in the U.S., and that does shape, pretty much everything President Obama does and says this year. However, I actually think in this case, with respect to the G8, in terms of the management of the summit and the sort of broad agenda, you know, that plays a relatively little part because this summit is fairly low key. I mean, it's intended to be that way, especially in a G20 world. That's where the president has put most of his emphasis. So there'll be sort of a general desire to show, you know, the president's leadership and foreign policy and ability to manage sort of global affairs. But in some sense, I don't think that this will be, a major opportunity for him to make a sort of I don't think it'll materially change the shape of his management of the summit. It may have some impact on the way he talks to the Europeans about growth and austerity, and I'll let Heather do that.
Well, Matt, thank you. Perfect segue. I think there's a complete understanding that in a worst-case scenario, should the European crisis begin to rapidly deteriorate, the impact on the U.S. economy 6 months before presidential election has profound implications for our economy and for our elections. I think that's why you've heard President Obama speak very clearly that while there was a desire to see Europe take more decisive action, more overwhelming action, be that on a firewall situation, overwhelming support to Europeans, European struggling banks, that Europe has the ability to fix this problem and needs to bring some urgency to that task. But again, clearly, now we're entering the third year of this crisis. The crisis has only deepened. Now, the good news is, I think we've been able to stabilize and ensure that American banks are going to be resilient, but we know the interconnectedness of our economies, particularly the European-American trading space, is tremendous. And we're going into a territory here that's, quite frankly, unknown if things continue to rapidly deteriorate with Greece. So this is a huge cloud of uncertainty that does not seem to be dissipating.
It's going to be a challenge politically to how you finesse this. It was one of the – perhaps many people thought it was one of the easiest campaign commitments he had made was to simply move this move this date forward on transition. I don't know what they're thinking of specifically. We know that there was a team from the White House and the State Department in Paris earlier this week talking to them about it. The sense I have is that they're coming up with some kind of a plan that would finesse this a little bit. I mean, the French were, as I said already, Sarkozy had said they would begin their ramp down in 2013. So there might be some kind of bridging of that they would do. Maybe they would retain some train. I mean, what the Canadians did, for example, a few years ago is they ended their participation in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations and moved purely to a training mission. The French, that might be one way where they could finesse this. So it would be partly that they'll slow down their. I mean, but basically that they're not going to end. They're mostly in the Kabul region and around. They wouldn't stop immediately their current defense operations there. On the Rocard visit to Tehran, I mean, I think the French have maintained an active track 2 and track 1.5 engagement with the Iranians. I think they hope to play some role. I had heard in Europe the last few days that there had been some hints that the Iranians were sending messages through the French. I don't know exactly what those were, but suggesting along the lines this idea that the makings of some kind of a deal is in the works and testing the waters a bit. Given the past relationships with some of the French socialist governments, I think the Iranians felt perhaps more comfortable with them, but we'll see. And then on other NATO issues, I mean, I think that this government is I think my sense is that they're going to be there had been some thought that they would reemphasize European defense over NATO. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think they're actually even worried about maintaining their current commitments within NATO and whether or not they can be sustained. So I had heard some hint that they might actually reduce their military presence within the NATO command structure, that they're not that crazy about missile defense. They're okay with the existing missile defense plan, but not the longer-term one of population defense, whether they will move away from that. That'll be an interesting sign. I hear they're also very interested in some cooperation on Africa, deepening cooperation with the U.S. on Africa, which might be seen as the quid for a reduced commitment to missile defense and some other things, on the idea that that's where they have some real strengths to bring. Anyway, so we'll see. But I think that's what I'm hearing on the French side. Thanks. No, there's going to have to be some further explanation of why, as you said, this dramatic change from just a year ago, the planning of a force of over 350,000, a $7 billion sort of price tag, and a recognition that I think it's some mix of both an assessment of the real capability, the needs of the Afghan security forces and the capacity to support them both on the Afghan side and the international community. So I think it's some, you know, the answer is some balance of those two, I think, and a recognition that, an Afghan national security force of 225,000 is still pretty substantial in light of the fact. And what I've heard I was with a number of folks that have been involved in some of these Afghan decisions the last few days, and you know they were noting that you know a force of that size, if it were well deployed and well utilized against an adversarial force of maybe you know several thousand active Talib fighters and other the Haqqani and these other fighters, you know if that's the capability that they're against, that should be sufficient. The question is, can you continue the mentoring and training? And I think that's going to be key. There's no doubt about it that certain elements of the Afghan army are seen as having become quite capable. They haven't always recounted themselves brilliantly, including in the recent incidents in Kabul, but there's a feeling that they certainly are getting better. The paramilitary national police, the so-called ANCOP, is also seen as having come a long way. Local police remains a problem, and what's going to happen on that is a key thing, because that's a big part of this long-term assistance package. But I think there's a feeling that in the context of Afghanistan's security, a force of that size is seen as at least you know some of the assessments from the military side. And it'll be interesting to see what the military commanders are saying when they're asked to testify on this. You know, do they think this is really adequate to deal with the security threat Afghanistan faces? On smart defense, there's no doubt about it that it could simply become a clever way to camouflage continuing European build downs. What I see it as is that as the sort of a commitment to kind of staunch the downward decline that really has been going on for the last 20 years in European defense spending, and a recognition that and on this feeling that the United States really may just be fed up with this, and there's a group of politicians who might think about even further cuts and even lesser commitment to Europe over the longer term, unless Europe shows that it's at least staunching that decline and trying to show that it is working more effectively. At some level, what we want most is all of the defense reviews that some of the key allies like the British and the French have taken the last few years were taken largely with very little coordination and consideration for what that meant for the overall alliance posture. So in some ways, what smart defense, and this is really what I think the U.S. is pushing for, with certainly what Secretary Panetta is pushing for in this 2020 vision, is let's identify what are the key capabilities we need within the alliance. Let's all agree that before we start slashing these, that let's make sure that we understand what that's going to mean for the alliance. So how do we use the NATO defense planning process and other mechanisms that we have to ensure that we have the capabilities we need, and even though we know that we will have some reduced resources? And then this idea of regional cooperation. cooperation, the British and the French leading the way, other Nordic-Baltic cooperation, other areas where Europe still spends an awful lot of money on defense, and they could get more from it if they pooled and shared some of their capabilities, not necessarily for big procurement projects, but just in normal deployments, activities, training. There's all sorts of redundancies that they have in maintaining very small national defense systems. And then some of them really will have to move to, and this goes to my comment about sovereignty, to niche capabilities where they're not going to have full spectrum forces. They're not going to be able to sustain them. Only the French and the British and a few others are going to really maintain it. Even they will not truly, I mean, because the British won't have a through-deck aircraft carrier for at least 10 years. So they're not going to have full spectrum. How can they keep these niches active and show that they're still contributing? And I think that's the best we can hope for in this smart defense initiative.
Karen.
Yes, Karen Bohan from the Reuters. I have a question for Heather and maybe Matthew. What is the level of comfort or lack thereof at the White House with Oman's economic policies? On the one hand, President Obama has pushed this argument that now is not the time for austerity. That's more of a medium-term, a longer-term goal that, it's a time to get growth going, which Oman definitely believes, but his policies are very far to the left of this president. And so I'm just wondering, what kind of conversation is going to take shape there, and is there some discomfort with how he may manage the French economy?
I think that the beginning of the comfort is going to start today in the discussions between Hollande and Merkel in Berlin on that balance. Can Europe achieve the balance of requiring deep structural reforms and austerity in light of really few limited options because of deficit spending and debt levels, and how to bring immediate relief in providing growth. And then when President Hollande comes to the White House, I think, again, there is great convergence between Washington and Paris about creating that balance. My driving concern is, how do you bring about this growth right now? Because that's when it's needed, right now. And many of the initiatives that Europe is floating have extremely long cycles. In our parlance, this is not shovel-ready projects. And if anyone is familiar with how the European Investment Bank does its business, it takes years, unless they're willing to make some significant changes to that. How cohesion and regional funds are utilized takes a very long time. And if, in fact, they're not going to do some direct, deficit stimulus spending, I'd like to see and understand how this growth agenda is going to be implemented and be able to affect some relief right now before the Greeks return to the ballot box next month. So I think that's the incompatibility. The thematic approach, everyone agrees. How you get to that level of detail, I think we need to see additional details. And we certainly need to see some signaling from Berlin, whether this is just more, okay, we'll go along with this, or they're thinking big and bold and really changing the dynamics that we're seeing, particularly in the periphery today. And Matt, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Thanks. Margaret Talib with Bloomberg. I had a few. I'm sorry. Let's try to be fast. Can you talk about Pakistan's role? Do we know what Pakistan's role is going to be now at NATO and how that will play out? Do we know anything about the bilats that the president is going to have probably on Sunday? Do you think Libya represented a high watermark in terms of NATO engagement? Does the fiscal crisis and weariness about Afghanistan and stuff mean that NATO will recede, and how much will we get a sense of that from the summit?
Take the first one and the last one. I'm sorry, you said on the
Pakistan.
Pakistan, right? Sorry, the Pakistan's. The word is today that the Pakistanis have hinted that they. Well, that the NATO has issued and that they had suggested, one of their senior officials had suggested, it's time to open up the transit corridor to allow these NATO tankers and other supply vehicles to begin moving again into Afghanistan. I don't know that that's actually been taken yet, but then that implying that there would be then a NATO, and that NATO would issue an invitation to have Pakistan come to the meeting of ISAF countries as that's part of the overall NATO meeting. So that seems to be a positive development. It's been a huge issue, and of course, in the aftermath of the bin Laden attack and other disruptions, there's been a major disruption, of course, in that supply route, and adding to the importance of the northern distribution network through Russia and the Central Asian countries. On Libya, I think Libya may not be a high water mark. It was not the most stressful operation the alliance could encounter in the future. It was one where I think the U.S. calculated that the British and the French, along with the contributions of a number of other smaller allies who made fairly sized allies and partners such as Sweden, that made fairly significant contributions and capabilities. It showed that actually they could undertake a fairly sophisticated operation with relatively limited casualties to the civilian population and exercise this responsibility to protect and NATO's contribution to international security. I think that there's a strong recognition in the alliance that NATO might encounter similar kinds of, if not exactly that type of mission, but certainly missions that stressful in the future, if not more so. And so hence a desire to rule out the notion of there's going to be no declaration of, no more Afghanistans, no more, that there's a recognition that the world remains pretty unpredictable and volatile, and the alliance has to be prepared to undertake some fairly robust expeditionary missions, as well as classical conventional defense. So, trying to balance that in the way they go about their defense procurements, and to maintain again these capabilities through the Smart Defense Initiative and other things that will allow the alliance to respond to this range of threats that might be out there. So, I think certainly nobody has the resources or the willingness to commit to something like Afghanistan, but I think shorter-term missions that might still require fairly robust military capabilities, I certainly think all the allies agree they've got to be prepared for that.
To be honest, I don't know the bilat schedule. I'm sorry, unless...
Yeah, no, I would imagine there'll be a few walks in the wood within the G8 and having, I think, some good and intense conversations. Again, I think the G8 setting provides a smaller, more intimate setting for these key European leaders and President Obama to talk about this debt crisis. That's a more comfortable setting, I think, clearly, than the
Chicago.
G20. Are you talking Chicago or G8? I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry, I could only that. Just one final comment to Steve's. I mean, this is truly about political will. European leaders have to have the political will to increase defense spending, or they do not. And in some ways, what I'm watching for is, will European allies replenish that equipment that was used and in short supply during Operation Unified Protector in Libya? Will they be making adjustments and replenishing defense budgets following their operational tempo in Afghanistan? These are the questions sort of hiding behind the headlines and smart defense and new initiatives. Will we see the political leaders will place funding in defense budgets in light of great austerity? That is the question, and that is the proof that Europe is willing to commit, I think, scarce resources to a greater purpose.
Matt, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay. Julie, and then we'll go over here.
I
think, quite frankly, the role is somewhat limited, but nevertheless, I think the president can play a role of listening, helping leaders find common ground. I think that when the administration made the decision that the U.S. would not contribute to the IMF fund, and has provided, though, advice how we addressed the crisis in 2008. Obviously, there's been a lot of interaction and coordination between the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, opening credit lines. I mean, this is incredibly valuable. But we don't, we're not in this game, quite frankly. This is really for Europe to sort out. And that has certainly been the administration's approach and policy to that. We're sitting on the bleachers. A bit, and we're going to have to watch how this plays out with the frustration and recognizing that it will have a profound impact for the global economy and for the U.S. economy. But there's a limit, but I'm sure the president will use good offices to do everything he can to help facilitate a European solution.
No, it's fine. I completely agree with that. I just would say that I think it is probably a calculated, decision by the White House to put the onus on Europe to fix this, because they do have the resources to do it. That's not the issue. So they don't need IMF funding to solve the problem. And so I think they're sort of deliberately, whether it's the right strategy or not is another question, but I think they're sort of consciously trying to put the onus on the Europeans to do this. But I agree. I think the leverage, you know, that said, is relatively limited. But the anxiety will be real, and that will come out, I'm sure, in what President Obama says to the European leaders. I think we'll have to do a separate briefing on the G20, which is coming up in a month. Yeah. But on the G8, I mean, I personally think that there is still a role. I think that the last year, and, you know, I was inside then, I think that there was some real soul searching about whether the G8 was really worthwhile, because it had, you know, gotten to be, and particularly under, frankly, French leadership had gotten a little bit the cost-benefit of doing this large undertaking, I think, had tipped towards, you know, a concern about the cost of so much effort with so little payout. But then, you know, the Arab Spring happened, and I think it really did. I mean, if given those circumstances, you probably would have wanted to gather that particular group of countries, or at least many of them, in any event, to talk about how to respond to that and those dramatic developments. And so it was, you know, very convenient that the G8 was right there. And I think it gave it sort of refreshed the White House's thinking about the G8 and realized that this is a group of countries that still have, you know, they still are the leading industrialized democracies, you know, plus at least one hanger-on. And, you know, and they have sort of shared historical and current day capability, you know, and interests and so forth in common. And so there is a useful role for a conversation among these people about, you know, how do you see these problems? What do we do about it, you know, individually or collectively? And I think there still is a place for the G8. And this year, I think the Eurozone problem has given it particular focus again. So I think it continues and probably serves a niche role in the geometry of the world architecture, but I don't think it's going to be. I mean, this administration has made a clear commitment to the G20 as the place to resolve, you know, international economic issues first and foremost. So I think it won't ever play the role it once played. And so I'm sorry for Japan, because you were one of eight then, and now you're one of 20. But
right over here.
I mean, I know, Heather, you may have views on that. I think, and I know it's hard to accept this, but I actually think there is real value in the conversation itself, because, you know, the president, first of all, the event is an action-forcing event that forces the Europeans to, you know, explain what they're doing, and the president has a chance to ask about that and to indicate his anxiety, if not apply any leverage. So I actually think the conversation does help enhance understanding and, frankly, put a little bit of peer pressure on the Europeans to, you know, to move. In terms of, you know, it concretely being able, or I'm going to mix metaphors if I say move the ball, specifically move the ball down the field, I don't think that's, I personally don't think that you'll be able to take a tape measure and measure after that event how far the ball moved down the field. But I do think it plays a useful role in the overall evolution. And if there's some disaster on the, you know, in the next 48 hours, which is, you know, not, I'm not predicting that. Please don't write that down. But if there were, you know, then you might want actually this group to get together and decide what are we going to do today to address it.
Well, and I think in some ways the G8 really over the last decade or so has been about the, you know, how many leaders can you bring and how many initiatives, you know, it's about sort of that outcome driven result, which is important. But in a way, we're getting back to the original spirit of the creation of first the G5, the G6, the G7 in the mid-70s during the oil shocks, during, you know, great uncertainty in the mid-70s on the global economy. You have a group of like-minded, value-based leaders that are trying to have an intimate conversation to understand where this is going. And it's not the flashy, splashy show off, you know, and then making big pledging commitments. It's a conversation. And I think in some ways, because of where we are with the European debt crisis and obviously the transformation that is occurring in the West, whether that's Japan, Europe, the United States, they need to have a conversation about this. And this is going to be a leader-driven model. So the leaders better have a confidence and an understanding of how they're proceeding, because to proceed separately would be a disaster. They're going to have to proceed together in some tandem. And I think that's maybe not the headline and you can really write about it, but that's what has to happen, I think, to navigate through these incredibly choppy waters right now.
You go right over here. Ewan, could you?
There's been no or hardly any mention so far about Syria. Is that not going to play at all in the G8 or NATO? And again, coming back to the domestic election, when the decision was made to have this in Chicago, was there not a sense that this was going to be a showpiece for Obama in the run-up to election? So has that gone by the wayside? And I mean, I don't know how U.S. domestic politics works, but the idea of lots of protesters, maybe trashing parts of Chicago or making a fuss, I mean, that's not going to particularly play well either.
I don't think any of the allies want to do Syria. That's part of the problem. But most seriously, no. Syria is certainly will be on the it'll be discussed, I'm sure, but it's not part of the NATO summit agenda. Or is there any inclination to take it on? They're still basically seen as supporting the diplomatic efforts, the UN plan, et cetera, that. But I think, and some of you may have seen Elizabeth Sherwood Randall spoke here last week about how the U.S. administration was viewing this and whether or not, the most immediate question for NATO would be, has Turkey requested some kind of steps to ensure its security if there were some cross-border action by the Syrian forces in hot pursuit, or there have been shots fired across the border, and she said that there had not been a specific request for defense preparations or other kinds of assistance to Turkey in that light. Right now, I mean, there's certainly no consensus to support either some kind of a NATO force to protect a safe haven area or even humanitarian corridors. But whether or not things will move in that direction at some point, I think I wouldn't rule it out. As political pressure build, but right now the consensus isn't there to take on that kind of an action. But I think there is a recognition that you could, at a minimum, have some calls from the Turks and others to protect safe havens that are established along their borders or other kinds of actions. To stop killing in Syria itself. But right now, that's not in the cards. I think the Chicago summit is still probably seen as a net plus. I have not heard of any sense that there are expectations of big demonstrations. My sense is that clearly the city of Chicago and others were concerned about big disruption, and the administration concerned about big disruptions in the from various elements of the anti-globalization movement, and that would be more of a that would be more detrimental, and that would set a bad tone. That might have been animating the move to Camp David, but in Chicago, I don't think they're bracing for that. What I think they do hope is that it will have some resonance in showing the middle of the country that why we do still have an alliance, what its value is, and despite their shortcomings, why it's still worth keeping.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I mean, when these hosting decisions come around, it's fairly typical for the president to choose, a place that he's comfortable with, and, that's his hometown, and I don't think he needs to have a summit there in order to win the state of Illinois. So I think it's probably not directly related to his election chances. I agree that I haven't heard any real concern about Chicago being, 1968 redux next week, but that's always possible. But I'm sure they've learned how to manage those issues. So I don't think there's a huge expectation of that. Syria will be, as I mentioned, on the agenda at the G8, but I don't think that will produce any common action. But probably again a conversation, and President Medvedev will be there. I'm sorry, Prime Minister Medvedev will be there. I was going to try to get through this without mixing the two up. Will be there, and I'm sure that part of the focus will be on trying to understand the Russian position and maybe try to bring the Russians more in line with the rest of the group.
It's Anna with ARD German Radio. That would be a question for Heather and Stephen concerning the defense spending in Europe. And there has always been a criticism on the side of the U.S. that European allies just don't spend enough. I think this criticism has been around or is as old as the alliance itself. Do you think the criticism this time is of a different nature, of a different quality? Thanks.
No, I don't think the concern has really changed fundamentally, but there is this concern that Gates articulated last year that this could really erode political support for the alliance at a time when the U.S. is looking very much. I mean, if you go onto the Hill today, and the kinds of questions you get, even from longtime supporters of NATO, is, well, who's a security producer, who's a consumer? And there's a strong sentiment that a number of key countries, and Germany is very much in the forefront of that, are simply not doing enough on defense and not sharing burdens and risks equitably. And so, as I agree with what Heather said, I think that not only is there a desire, that the 2% commitment that the alliance had laid out is not a perfect metric, but it is some representation of a level of seriousness. And you see some smaller countries, like I was just in Estonia, a very small ally, but a country that contributes well above its weight, made a commitment to get back to that 2%. Latvia, some other smaller countries have made that commitment. The notion that a number of other countries that have much more capacity, if they move back in that area, I think you could see a lot more capacity from European defense. So I think there's a strong sense that Europe could do more to share this, since it's sharing in the benefits of global economy and our prosperity that's maintained by the global U.S. military presence. There's no reason that Europe couldn't do more, and that indeed in the future we might see more actions like Libya, where Europe took the lead and the United States was in a supporting role in some relatively limited operations. Not that that's the preferred model, but that it would be one where there's no reason why there'd be certain security missions that the Europeans could take the lead on this, and the U.S. could be, given its broader global commitments, or it could be a partnership in other regions of the world as well. But Europe has to have the capabilities to be able to sustain that.
Okay, Chris, right over here.
Joe Shaw with NHK. Going back to the move to Camp David, how much of that do you think was motivated, when you say the intimate setting, was motivated to make Putin more comfortable being separate from Chicago, where the NATO summit is being held, where there's some disagreement, and how much damage is done, if that was the case, how much damage is done by him not showing up? I mean, not just in the U.S.-Russian relationship, but also in the Russian-European relationships.
Well, just on the first part, I mean, I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that none of the other theories really is right about the move. I think the reason for the move was that when President Obama, the original decision to have the G8 in Chicago next to NATO was based on sort of implicit in what I was saying before about the White House feeling the G8 was no longer something that needed to stand alone as a full, dog and pony show with all the pomp and circumstance, and they wanted to sort of in principle attach it to another summit and have it be a shorter event attached to some other reason for a gathering of most of these leaders. And so that was the original reason to choose Chicago. I think when the president actually looked at the plans for the events, he saw, oh my God, we're going to have this, sort of huge group and, traffic jams and noise, and it's not going to be possible to have the kind of conversation that we want to have at the G8. And I think that was, 95% of the reason for the move. There may have been a small element of, security concerns. I don't buy the Putin thing, but that's, that's me.
Well, no, and I think it gets back to the Syria question, the opportunities that are lost because President Putin will not be here, and Syria is the most directly impacted on that. Working in a small group setting to try to find a way to allow Moscow to at least at the UN Security Council and others play a more helpful role. It's not in my recent memory, Matt, Steve, chime in here, where a sitting head of state did not come to a U.S.-hosted event. I mean, there's obviously extraordinary circumstances, but I think even today's statements from the leader of the Duma's Foreign Policy Committee, again, made a very clear statement that this was, in fact, a signal to both to Washington and I would say the other European leaders on their position on the December parliamentarian elections, on Syria, on other issues. Now, again, again, a lot of this is rhetorical, back and forth. We appreciate that. But to me, it was an extraordinary event, and I don't believe it bodes well in the near term for working constructively with Moscow on some of these more significant issues. And Iran is also going to be another issue where, again, a lost opportunity to work closely with Moscow.
Let me just clarify. I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's right. Your question was about the reason for the move, and I think the reason for the move had nothing to do with Putin. However, I do believe that Putin's decision not to come may have been related to his concern about, you know, about what was going to be talked about both in Chicago and at Camp David, and that's very possible, but not my area of expertise, so I can't say, but I believe that. That makes sense to me. And I think it probably will have a detrimental impact on the conversation.
Two words on that. I think the Russian excuse
that Putin is busy putting the new government together is not very credible, since he's been running the government for the last 8 years anyway. But so I think this is a signal, I think, very much to say that, you know, we see the G20 fits Russia's vision of the future world order, of a more multipolar world, much better. And I think it is a signal, immediate signal of maybe a desire to duck some tough issues. And since Russia is seen as key to any kind of move to get Assad out, I think. And they don't have much to offer yet on Iran. There's a signal that they wanted to avoid some tough issues. But I think it's also the longer term is the suggestion that their preferred vehicle may be the G20 in the future. Because there were days when, in the past, where Russia was fighting to be there at a time when some allies, some members of the G8 and G7 were saying, well, Russia shouldn't show up given what was going on in Chechnya or other problems at the time. And so it is striking that Russia's made a conscious decision to not participate and be seen as part of yet another club where they're an exclusive club where they're a member.
Can you identify yourself, please?
Oh, sorry.
This coming year. I mean, this year. So President Obama is not going to go to APEC in
Vladivostok.
And I can absolutely categorically tell you that the Russians knew about that 18 months ago. We looked at the calendar and said, you know, the president's not going to go. If you do it in September, you need to do it after the election in November. And they said, it's too cold in Vladivostok in November. We're going to do it in September.
That's
if the president come,
that could.
So seriously, I mean, I'm absolutely 100% confident that this is not that was not a snub, and that this is not a retaliation for that, because both sides were very clear about that. So I can categorically dismiss that as the theory. Other theories sound more credible to me. I mean, like the ones that have been mentioned here.
That there's been the report, although it's been denied by Obama administration officials, that Turkey in fact objected. There was not, to the best of my knowledge, there was not a plan to have a meeting of all partners. Now, there's various levels of partnership. It's complicated. Because the focus here was going to be Afghanistan and capabilities, and some level of partnership. I think that was the decision that was made. But there is a question. Israel is not a contributor to the Afghanistan mission, so it would not have been included in that group. If you had had a country, interesting is that there was not a decision to have a meeting of all of the so-called Mediterranean dialogue partners, which are basically all the states on the Mediterranean littoral, with whom NATO has been cooperating for some time, even going back. There's an active mission, kind of terrorism mission, a maritime kind of terrorism in the Mediterranean that a number of those states contribute information to, that began in 2001. And so then also this notion that in the aftermath of the Arab Awakening that there would be some more effort to include a number of these countries and have a collective meeting. I think for whatever reason, and I have no doubt that the Turks would not have been pleased with having the Israelis there in the absence of an apology over the flotilla incident. And they've made some statements on other issues within NATO with regard to that and other cooperation with Israel. But I don't know that there was, at least from what everything I've heard, there was not a specific plan to have a big meeting of all the Mediterranean dialogue. And then there's also some Gulf states and another partnership arrangement that there was no plan to have a comprehensive meeting. But it is interesting that in the aftermath of having proven through Libya that NATO was not a toxic NATO's engagement in the Arab Middle East was not toxic, which had been the French position at the beginning of Libya. It is interesting that there was not a decision to talk a bit more about how the alliance and physically have a member of these countries there to talk about how we were going to advance the partnership with them. Now, some of them will be there as part of the contributors to the Afghan mission, but not all of them. It is true that a number of those, in that group of 13, will be several of those countries that have been key contributors to the Afghanistan mission, and they're seen as, you know, among the more capable and or you know, substantial financial resources to the Afghan mission. But NATO is not what the NATO strategic concept says is that NATO recognizes that the environment has become more complicated, more global. Threats to alliance security can emanate from various corners, but there's not an expectation that NATO that NATO also will pivot to Asia, or that there will be a new engagement in the Far East. There are some areas of cooperation, though, that we already see in terms of, say, the counterpiracy mission that NATO is contributing. NATO has a element that is part of the international, a number of international forces that are operating in the Gulf of Aden, maritime security, counterpiracy, other missions where there may be some further engagement farther afield from the North Atlantic region. But there's no support, certainly among the European allies, for having NATO go global in the fullest sense of the word, but a recognition that it may have to, in order to protect alliance territory, it may have to act outside the North Atlantic region in some cases, and that some of these key countries in East Asia who share values and have many common interests have proven themselves quite valuable.
Time for just a couple more. This gentleman over here.
Yes, I think certainly the president would encourage Chancellor Merkel to, in fact, create that balance. And the administration, Secretary Geithner and others, have been encouraging not just an austerity-only approach to the debt crisis. And I think the chancellor will respond positively to that. As I said before, the devil is all in the details on this. Everyone agrees that economic growth is a good thing. We all agree that world peace is a good thing. How do we accomplish it? And again, most immediately for Europe, how can this be accomplished right now to break this vicious cycle, in my view, of where austerity is now crushing growth? And now at the ballot box, the Greek people and the French people in many ways expressed themselves just last week that that's not going to be the way they're going to approach this challenge. So they're going to be great agreement on this front. I don't know if it's going to affect the situation on the ground, and that's what you're interested in Spain.
I'm going to go with Howard. You got the benediction.
Great. Yes, for Stephen, I guess just simply, can there be a meaningful meeting of international partners, players in Afghanistan without Pakistan if they don't resolve this issue? And don't come. Can there be a meaningful gathering discussion of that?
Yeah, that's what I was hearing. Just in the that's right. And I think that's true. Certainly, it would be a more effective meeting. I mean, the key question. I mean, NATO is not going to set the context for all of the activities in relief and assistance to Afghanistan over the longer term. It's not playing a role in the regional so-called regional solution. It's not going to play a role directly. It's providing some of the security context for any other kind of reconciliation process internally, where Pakistan's role is going to be so important, and working with India and others. So that, I think yes, it would be much better to have Pakistan there, just partly because of the disengagement and the continued sustainment of the NATO presence there. Pakistan continues to play an important role. NATO has been able to work around it through this Northern Distribution Network and other mechanisms, but that's that's suboptimal, and there certainly would be good reasons. Particularly, it's certainly a lot easier to supply forces operating in the south and the east through supply routes from Pakistan. So that would be a good sign of some kind of movement back on that. But I think there's a lot of other issues still, and you know, better coordination too in the handoff of Pakistan. The coordination that had been going developing in some positive ways in the past with the Pakistani armed forces into their operations in the tribal areas in the Northwest Frontier provinces. And the efforts to, you know, continue to put the pressure on you know, some of these insurgent forces. If some of that could be built back, that would also be a positive sign for this longer term transition.
I want to thank everybody for coming. Our transcript of this event will be out later today. You can of course follow us at CSIS for updates, and there will also be audio and video of this posted on CSIS.org later today. Thanks very much for coming.